top military official in Iraq says that troops will have to stay there possibly till 2010. We'll have that report in a little while. But first, a figure of Christ digitally added to a photograph of surgeons at work, his hand guiding the surgeons. Two pictures side by side, two hospitals in Pakistan, one serving millions of Muslims, the other only a few thousand Christians, but it's the one that receives thousands in U.S. aid. And a small village in Kenya, women arriving at a tin-roofed hut to get food, medical care for their babies, and lessons in Christianity. These are just a few of the images from a recent series in the Boston Globe, detailing how in the last 6 years, the Bush administration has doubled the amount of foreign aid going to faith-based groups, including Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, and the Samaritan's Purse, groups that in many cases have conflated delivering foreign aid with delivering a Christian message. Two of the authors of that series join us now. Michael Cranis is with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Peter Kanellis is here as well. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Robin.
Peter, I want to start with you. In the first part of the series, you write about the constitutional requirements for separation of church and state. Tell us specifically, first of all, what has changed under the Bush administration?
Well, what's changed is the interpretation of the rules separating church and state. Prior to the Bush administration, a common practice was that government aid had to be distributed in a different place from where worship or prayer is conducted. Bush has eliminated that requirement. The only requirement that remains is that they can't be delivering government aid at the exact same time as they're conducting services, which a lot of the groups say is sort of not much of a protection anyway, because you're not going to be conducting a breastfeeding class at the same time as you're going to be having a religious service. So what our reporters found is that many of these groups will schedule prayer and worship around government-funded health and education programs so that the same recipients who are in the U.S. government-funded class, for example, learning about new agricultural techniques, will immediately transition into a Christian worship service.
And there's also another distinction that's been blurred as to who can be hired for these agencies.
Lyndon Johnson wrote an executive order that basically said you cannot discriminate on the basis of religion if you're a government contractor. President Bush signed an executive order overturning Johnson, in which he said basically that you can discriminate in hiring. This specifically allowed you, if you're a government contractor in a faith-based group, to say, unless you're a Christian, you can't get this job that, by the way, we're paying for with taxpayer funds.
So relief organizations can legally hire only, say, evangelicals, and some of them told you that they make no bones about the fact that their goal is to convert, say, through the delivery of medicine. And you say that's what's happening.
Yes, this is Peter again. I think that, out in the field, there's no particular knowledge of the separation of church and state or the constitutional mandates. We found in the village in Kenya that you referenced at the start of the program that the esteem that the local people had for being taught about the importance of breastfeeding, this was an area where the religion actually dictated the children not be breastfed, which caused a lot of infant disease. They were so appreciative that their children were being saved that virtually the entire area converted to Christianity and believes that the Christian God has brought this great improvement in their lives.
There's another anecdote. A villager says that we used to carry milk and pour it in the river to appeal to our God, and our aid agency told us that was too much work.
I think she was just describing how she had practiced traditional African religion, and that pouring milk into the river was one of the rituals of that religion. But it's a sort of poignant quote, because she says, we now realize that that is a tiresome God, and that the Christian God is the God who cures us and saves us.
Well, of course, Michael Cranish, that could happen anyway. A villager could make an assumption. But are you saying this is also a concerted effort on the part of USAID, the government agency that gives out foreign aid money?
Well, I think at the agency, they realize that in relying on faith-based groups, that there's a reason that they're faith-based. They will maintain, if they were here, that there are separations that say you can't use the exact tax dollars that we're sending you for proselytization. That clearly is in the rule. What this series looked at, to a degree, in no way are we questioning great works that are done by faith-based groups in dangerous places all over the world. It's about the dual question of A, tax dollars being used, and B, changes that have been made given the country's history of separation of church and state.
Tell us about those changes. How exactly did President Bush implement this?
Well, President Bush, when he ran for president in 2000, he talked about a faith-based initiative. He'd had something similar in Texas that was certainly very popular, particularly among evangelicals. And when he came in, he said that there was discrimination, using his words, against faith-based groups, and that he wanted to, quote, open up billions of dollars of federal money to faith-based groups. I talked to a lot of faith-based organizations who, in fact, were already getting hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts, grants, and so forth from the federal government. And they said that they weren't discriminated against and that they were getting money.
Because that is fascinating. You spoke to many major churches, including the one President Bush was raised in, Episcopalian, and the one he now worships in, I believe it's Methodist. And they said they not only did they not see any problems, but they had no access to the president to tell him that.
The bishop, I talked to the bishop of the Episcopalian Church, for example, and he said that he basically has been shunted aside, not been able to meet with the president to talk about various concerns. But even a very conservative denomination, the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest denomination of Southern Baptists, they tell their churches not to take this money.
Well, there was apparently a lot of squeamishness about this blurring of church and state to the extent that moderate Republicans also voted against it. So President Bush couldn't get the bill passed that he wanted in Congress and said himself, speaking to a meeting of faith-based groups, "So I signed an executive order, and that means I did it on my own." What did he actually do?
In this case, he did something proactively. He issued a series of executive orders. And executive orders aren't supposed to directly override something Congress done, but they're orders that he can do if he thinks the president has the authority to issue an order. And in his case, that's what he did. He issued one order after another, setting up faith-based offices, using government funds to basically encourage people to apply for these grants, and also telling the agencies develop rules under which these programs can be used overseas. So in the case of the United States Agency for International Development, which gives out most of this money that we're talking about, they got the order from President Bush. They worked then for about 2 years and came up with a 65-page regulation. In the regulation, it says the agency was asked by some people to tell beneficiaries that they don't have to go to those services. And the agency considered that idea. And it says in the regulation, "We decided this wasn't necessary. We encourage them to tell people they don't have to go to services. We don't feel it's necessary to require it," the agency said.
Well, and what has been the effect of that, Peter? Are there villagers around the world who think they have to go to the Christian religious service in order to get the aid?
I think there are. And the larger concern is that, particularly when you're dealing with medical issues, that some of the contractors overseas may be portraying cures that come about through, you know, exposure to medicine or to new hygienic systems as being the work of Jesus. And it creates, some ethicists have suggested, you know, it creates kind of an unfair proselytizing situation where you're presenting the work of modern medicine as the work of God.
That's Peter Canellos. We've been talking to Peter and Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe. They just ran a four-part series on the impact of faith-based U.S. foreign aid. And you write, the role of evangelicals has changed foreign policy, both by focusing the Bush administration on issues like AIDS in Africa or genocide in the Sudan, but also perhaps endangering the relationship with potential allies in Muslim countries. We want to talk to you more about that, but I'm going to ask you both to hang on a moment because we've just reached Pam Hess from UPI. We plan to have Pam at the top of the program. We want to grab her now to talk about her expertise, which is the Pentagon and the military, because we have a lot of news from that corner today. Pam, welcome.
Thank you. Sorry for the technical problem.
Oh, that's okay. And there's word from the Pentagon that a Red Cross delegation has met with alleged September 11th mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 13 other high-value detainees at Guantanamo Bay. What do you make, first of all, of that meeting with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, we don't know that they definitely met with him because they won't tell us who they met with, but this is the first time the ICRC has been to Guantanamo since these 14 so-called high-value detainees have been transferred to Guantanamo from secret CIA and other agency detention centers around the world where no one could get to them. They were held incommunicado. So it's fairly significant on that point.
And we also want to talk to you while we have you about other big news out today, which is about troop levels. I mean, just a few months ago, we were hearing about the possibility of troop reductions in Iraq by the end of this year or next. Now we're hearing from the top U.S. general in Iraq that tough times there are expected to continue, more violence today, and that current U.S. troop levels in Iraq, which is about 140,000 soldiers, I believe, troops altogether, will hold steady for at least another 4 years. What's been the reaction to that?
It's a little less cut and dried than that, but it is a fairly significant announcement. The Army announced that they're planning for keeping 120,000 soldiers in Iraq over the next 4 years. The change here is that a couple of years ago, they had been building their budgets and doing their planning based on the notion that the U.S. would significantly reduce the number of troops by the end of 2006, maybe into the middle of 2007. So they've sort of switched that optimism. They've realized that they need to plan for the worst-case scenario at this point, and so that's what they're doing. What they want to do is make sure that they have all the funding in line and all the people lined up with enough advance notice and all the training lined up so that they can cut troops if they need to. But flowing in new troops is hard, and there's several thousand troops that are in Iraq right now who've already been there for a year and are, you know, staying for 15 or 16 months total, which sort of violates Army policy on the amount of time for deployment. They want to avoid that in the future, so they're doing that by planning for the worst-case scenario.
Well, and that begs the question, this is a pool of troops. There's no draft. Is there the sense that they will be able to redeploy different troops if the length of stay is that long?
Yeah, the Army says yes, and objective indications suggest that they can keep doing it. They have sized the Army so that they can keep about 15 brigades deployed at any one time with 15 in backup. They're at the level of about 16 or 17 brigades in Iraq right now, so they're definitely stressed, but they say they can keep doing it. But that sort of depends on nothing else going wrong in the world. If something else happens, they're going to have to rejigger what they have going on in Iraq.
Well, and could this something else be a real budget crisis? As you write, the U.S. military is spending $10 billion a month on both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's the Army particularly is really facing a tough bill. They've been getting somewhere south of $100 billion just to run the Army day-to-day for the last couple of years. It's gone up over the years, but they topped out at $100 billion. They now figured out that they actually need $130 billion just to run the Army because of the pace of operations that they're at. That doesn't account for the supplementals that they get from Congress to run the wars, which pays for ammunition, new weapons, body armor, that sort of thing. So they're really looking at a budget crunch, and they're actually going to the White House and asking for a raise of their top line. I think that they were only expecting to get $114 billion this year, and they're looking for $138 billion. And again, that's the Army base budget. That's not war funding. So they're really in a tight budget crunch. And the reason they got into this crunch is because of those assumptions that were made a couple of years ago. They figured we're going to have a certain number of troops in Iraq. It'll come down. We can handle this with supplementals. We tighten our belt a little bit. But because Iraq is dragging on, and it's dragging on at such a high level of troop commitment, they're looking at a really bad situation. Budget officials in the Army are calling it the Armageddon budget, which refers not to nuclear warfare, but just they don't know where this money is going to come from if it doesn't come from the White House.
Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI, on projections that current troop levels will stay pretty much the same in Iraq till 2010. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and when we come back, more on how faith-based foreign aid affects foreign policy. Much more ahead here and now. Stay with us. Conversation with Boston Globe reporters Michael Cranish and Peter Canellos. That paper just ran a four-part series on how foreign aid dollars are increasingly being spent by faith-based groups around the globe. And Peter, just tell us what happens when many of these groups, particularly the evangelical ones who've made no bones about their other goal, which is to convert people, what happens when they're working specifically in Muslim areas?
We found several things. I mean, one of the stories dealt with a loan program in Mombasa, Kenya, which is a majority Muslim area. And it's also considered sort of an important front in the war on terrorism because there's been a lot of Islamic activism in that area. And there's a program that receives government funds that gives loans only to Christian businesses, not to Muslim businesses. Now, the USAID grant pays for training for the people who receive the grants, and it's caused a lot of controversy on the ground in Mombasa. And the question that some critics have raised is, if the purpose of foreign aid is to win friends, why put foreign aid in a situation where you end up riling up the local population rather than pleasing the local population?
Right. I can't imagine the Jesus movie goes over very well there. Michael, the Jesus movie, remind us?
That was a very low-budget film made in 1979, and this is a film today that some people say has been viewed by 3 billion, B as in boy, people, and it's used by missionaries in all sorts of places around the world.
There are many, many pictures and many accounts of taking this movie through portable generators, you know, into really the most remote places in the world, and in some very, very obscure languages, 900 languages they've translated this movie into. The claim is that 200 million people have been converted because of this movie.
And again, most people would say that would be their business, except the film is now being shown by organizations receiving taxpayer money. Michael Cranish, you also addressed the concern that the religious right has been increasingly taking over USAID, sidelining long-respected secular groups such as CARE. In fact, you write of a campaign by religious groups to vilify CARE. Tell us the story of CARE.
In 2003, it was awarded a $50 million contract by the Bush administration to give out money to fight AIDS in Africa and Asia, and it was supposed to give the money to secular and faith-based groups, which it did. And what happened, however, is that they were strongly criticized, basically from the right, that they weren't giving it to the right kind of faith-based groups. They were accused of being, quote, anti-American and pro-prostitution. They were attacked strongly by the group Focus on the Family, which is run by James Dobson. And what happened is that this contract's being phased out, and that a different program that is more targeted towards faith-based groups and run by the U.S. government itself is being put in its place.
We understand there's a pledge that groups are asked to sign before they can receive aid money.
Right. As part of the approval for a large AIDS grant from Congress that was signed by President Bush, members of Congress put in a requirement that someone receiving these federal funds had to institute what was called an anti-prostitution pledge. Now, nobody that I know is for prostitution. A lot of these groups, however, do work with prostitutes, and some groups and some other countries do believe that unless they work closely with prostitutes, that they won't be as effective as they could be in fighting AIDS. In some countries, the infection rate for prostitutes is 50% or more. Brazil, for example, had been given a $40 million grant by the U.S. government to fight AIDS, and they refused to sign this pledge, saying one of their most effective strategies has been to work with prostitutes to stop the spread of AIDS. And so they basically said to the U.S. government, you can have your $40 million, and they refused to sign the pledge. Two other groups that refused to take the money sued the U.S. government, and so far they've won.
I was just going to say, Peter, what are some of the challenges to this? First of all, pushback from within the administration didn't go very well. Colin Powell was criticized when he discussed condoms, I think it was, while Secretary of State.
It's a situation where, you know, the people who are in favor of the faith-based initiative, particularly the evangelical groups, are extremely active and put a lot of pressure on the administration. I think the people who are against it, like Bishop Griswold, who Michael also referred to earlier, and others, find it very difficult to get through to the White House. You know, President Bush has created this entire initiative through executive orders, so it's really a question of who has the ear of the White House.
What about legal challenges?
Legal challenges are working through the system right now. The faith-based initiative itself has been sued by a group advocating separation of church and state. And that suit is moving through various procedural hurdles. Some legal specialists believe it will ultimately go to the Supreme Court.
Well, meanwhile, I want to ask both of you, you know, for many people, the bottom line is going to be, well, you know, I'm uncomfortable about this U.S. aid seen as being a Christian thing and appearing to be delivered from a Christian nation. But the bottom line is, does it work?
What we found is we found that there was no suggestion that the Christian groups that were getting the federal aid were doing a poor job in the strict, you know, living by the contract and delivering the aid. There also is no evidence that the secular groups that have gotten these contracts have done anything but a very, very good job. We're talking about government programs here, and there's no shortage of applicants. You know, you frequently hear people say, ah, but, you know, the Christian groups are the only ones that are willing to go into these places. In fact, what we're talking about here are government grants that are very competitive, and that there are lots of secular groups that are applying for and a lot of faith-based groups that are applying for them. The only question would be, with the relaxed rules that the Bush administration has put in charge, are some of the faith-based groups mixing a religious message in with the delivery of aid, and how do people feel about that?
And Peter, one last quick question. You did go to Angola. What's just an image that stays with you?
The image that stays with me is of the Evangelical Medical Center that is not complete, built completely apart from the city, and the contrast between the Evangelical Medical Center, which is indeed a wonderful facility and where U.S. Agency for International Development has given $830,000, but it's so removed from the people who need health care the most.
In fact, you positioned two pictures side by side in another part of the series of a beautiful, gleaming Christian facility next to a really rundown, filthy facility. And what was the distinction there? That was, I believe, in Pakistan.
Pakistan is a Muslim country. Obviously, there's a large part of the population in Pakistan that is either unfamiliar with or resistant to Christian facilities. There's also a cost difference that's very significant. The Christian hospital costs more. So the question there would be, by putting U.S. government money into the Christian hospital but not into the public hospitals, are you serving the most people and are you serving them best?
That's Peter Canellis. We also spoke with Michael Cranish. Both worked on this terrific four-part series in the Boston Globe exploring the role of religion in U.S. foreign aid. Michael, Peter, thanks both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you want a link to the series, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR. Former Congressman Mark Foley's top aide, Kirk Fordham, is giving testimony to House investigators in the congressional page scandal today. Fordham says he has proof that he told House Speaker Dennis Hastert's staff that Foley had inappropriate contact with teenage male pages as far back as 2002. Hastert's office denies that. Foley resigned last month after sexually explicit electronic messages he sent to pages became public. Meanwhile, President Bush is showing his support for Speaker Dennis Hastert by campaigning with him in Chicago today. Well, what impact is all of this having on the campaign trail? Democrats need to win 15 seats to gain control of the House in the November elections. Republicans, of course, need to hold on to those seats. And today we touched down in North Carolina with Professor Hunter Bicot of the Elon University poll in Elon, North Carolina. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Professor, we understand that the Foley scandal is showing up in the campaigns there in a somewhat circuitous way in at least one campaign. It factored into a controversial press release.
Well, Larry Kissel, who's running against Robin Hayes in the 8th District in North Carolina, issued a press release tying Robin Hayes to Representative Foley and tried to tie the CAFTA vote with Hayes and Foley's sex scandal.
The CAFTA vote is the Central American Free Trade Agreement. The Democrat there, Larry Kissel, is critical of the Republican incumbent Robin Hayes for his vote for CAFTA, right?
Yes, that was a key vote for that area. CAFTA is important for that district because it's a textile district and it's lost jobs incredibly. And most of those jobs have gone overseas because they deal with textiles. That district runs from Charlotte to Fort Bragg. Democrats pushing CAFTA hard because there are so many people who made their livelihoods in the textiles who are now working at Walmart and McDonald's.
And Representative Hayes' family is very tied in with the textile industry.
Yes, they were the textile barons, so to speak, in that area. He made his fortunes, got out while the getting was good, and everybody else has been subjected to the fortunes of CAFTA and NAFTA.
So tying Mark Foley's name to Robin Hayes' name in regards to CAFTA could possibly in that area be more damaging to Hayes than tying Hayes to the Page sex scandal.
Exactly. It becomes an issue of trust. Who can you trust? Someone who sold us out down the river and the party that you can't trust to take care of their own house? Or do you want to try to give Democrats a chance?
Well, and the Democrat, Larry Kissel, again, was pretty far behind the incumbent Republican Robin Hayes. Prior to this, what do your new polls show?
Well, it's tightened up considerably. He's within a few percentage points at this time.
It was probably so unexpected that he only has, we're reading, $88 in his bank account. This is the Democratic challenger.
Well, that's why you issue press releases instead of take out ads.
Well, there you go. Well, what were the most important issues to voters in your area before the Foley scandal?
Before the Foley scandal, North Carolinians pegged war in Iraq and terrorism and security as the top issues. At a state level, they see education, economy, and immigration.
And how is that playing out in another race that you're watching in Western North Carolina's 11th District?
Pete Shuler, the former Redskins quarterback, and Charles Taylor, the incumbent. This is a tight race. It's called a toss-up. What's going on here is Taylor is pushing the immigration issue hard. Shuler is a conservative Democrat who's pushing health care, education. It's incredibly interesting because Taylor is in about his eighth term, hasn't really had any challenge, and Shuler's coming in as a conservative Democrat, social conservative. He's gotten the backing of the old Democratic Party machine, and so he's benefiting incredibly from that. And this is a very conservative Republican area.
Western North Carolina, up in the mountains?
Yes.
Well, the races in your area are also interesting. Because of the political ads that are popping up on YouTube, this is the internet video sharing site that attracts 100 million visitors a day, and campaigns have caught on to that fact. Tell us a little bit about that tactic in your area.
Well, we've had a campaign up in the 13th District, which is Vernon Robinson versus Brad Miller. Miller's the incumbent Democrat. Vernon Robinson is a Republican, a black Republican, running very vicious ads about immigration, homosexuals, terrorism, racial quotas. He has one called The Twilight Zone.
Homosexuals are mocking holy matrimony, and the lesbians and feminists are attacking everything sacred. Liberal judges have completely rewritten the Constitution. You can burn the American flag and kill a million babies a year, but you can't post the Ten Commandments or say God in public.
One nation under...
7 out of every 10 black children are born out of wedlock, and Jackson and Sharpton claim the answer is racial quotas. And the aliens are here, but they didn't come in a spaceship. They came across our unguarded Mexican border by the millions.
I don't think it's going to play out. He tried this 2 years ago in another district. He doesn't even live in the district. And he was castigated for it then. I think it's just a lot of show and no substance.
We also mentioned Larry Kissel, who's the Democratic challenger of Republican incumbent Robin Hayes, and we mentioned he had no money. Well, some of his supporters have put some videos on YouTube. Professor Bicot, I'm wondering if this could become a place for people who have no money because it's, you know, the postings are free.
Well, I think it's going to be very strategic for those people. The problem is it's going to reach a segment of the population that doesn't really vote. So you don't know how it's going to work out in the election.
You mean younger people who don't go to the polls?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, before we let you go, we want to talk about a new campaign launched by a group called Devout Democrats. It features legendary UNC basketball coach Dean Smith. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is a group of Christian Democrats who are trying to make it known that not only are the Democrats Christians, that they also are politically active Democrats. And so it's to counter the whole notion the Republican has the lock on traditional family values.
Is this seen as unusual, a coach coming on and saying, I'm devout and a Democrat? First of all, that a coach, such a popular coach, would even talk about politics there. Is that unusual?
It's not completely unusual. It is rare. He only comes out for political campaigns and things that he thinks strongly about. He's campaigned for, in the past, for a Republican candidate for governor who was a former basketball player. So he's very loyal, but he is a very devout Christian. And this will play fairly well up in the Western District, in the 11th District, and may benefit Shuler quite a bit.
It's interesting. This seems to be coming up from the grassroots. A college student started this group, Devout Democrats, but it's what analysts have been telling Democrats they need to do, seize back some of the literally some of the moral high ground. How do you see that playing in that area, you know, Democrats talking about their faith?
I think it's going to work well in the 11th District because Shuler is one that has been touting that heavily as being a non-typical Democrat, so to speak.
This is Heath Shuler, the football player.
Yes, football the Democrat trying to unseat Charles Taylor in the 11th District.
So, Professor Hunter Bicot of the Elon University poll up there in Elon, North Carolina, what are your predictions? Do you think there will be a shakeup in North Carolina's congressional races?
I think Shuler will probably pull it off. He broke 50% in a poll not too long ago. For Hayes Kissel, I think Hayes will probably stay in. I think the Vernon Robinson race, I think, is just going to make for some good study in the future about political communications.
Professor Hunter Bicot of the Elon University poll there in North Carolina. We'll check back with you afterwards to see how you did.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Still to come, a new searing documentary on clergy sex abuse in the Catholic Church and how that scandal played out in California. You're listening to Here and Now. Turning to sports, and starting with a sad note, Yankee pitcher Corey Lytle was killed yesterday when his plane crashed into that New York City high-rise. His death was on the front pages and on the sports pages today. We want to talk about all the news in sports, and we do that always with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. And, Bill, we do start on this sad note, the death of Corey Lytle.
It was a terrible accident. Yeah. There's not much else to say except, of course, sympathies to his family.
Right. It just was one of those very odd things, and it understandably overshadowed what had been the sports story in New York earlier in the week, and that of Joe Torre, who's going to stay put as manager of the Yankees even after that team made an early exit out of the playoffs. And frankly, after yesterday's accident, we're going to move on from that. I was almost glad the Yankees weren't in the playoffs, having had something like that happen to them. But what do you think about Torre staying? Smart move on?
Absolutely. It's evidence that boss Steinbrenner is not insane. Joe Torre gets the team to the postseason every year, wins the division title virtually every year, you don't fire a guy like that just because the team isn't able to take the next step. He's operating with the biggest budget in baseball, and he's done a terrific job of keeping all those gigantic egos pointed more or less in the same direction. It's not his fault that they haven't gotten it done in the postseason.
Right. It was the Detroit Tigers who kicked them out. I think it was 3-1. Some of the Yankees, I think, heard saying that the better team, meaning them, lost. Do you agree?
Well, they have to believe that, and frequently athletes believe it, but they rarely say it.
I know, but they're Yankees.
You have to sort of say, whatever, come on, go home, count your money, play golf, have a nice winter.
Right.
Tigers are a great story, of course, Robin, because they were so good through most of the regular season, and they had been so bad 3 years ago, lost more games than any other team in the major leagues. Then they completely collapsed at the end of the season, almost missed the postseason, almost missed getting in, and then, of course, turned it all around again, beat the Yankees, and look like they're back to the Tigers of July, and they're
right.
Playing magnificently now.
Rolling along last night, they won. It was game two of the American League series, Detroit beating Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have a 2-game lead. So what are your thoughts going ahead?
Well, I like Detroit. The way they're playing now, nobody beat the Tigers when they were on top of their game all summer. Later in the fall, they weren't so good. If they keep playing that way, that should be a pretty good bet. Mets St. Louis is a terrific series, I think, because the Mets have so far prevailed to this point despite losing two starting pitchers, and there aren't too many teams that you would look at and say, oh, well, that's okay. They can continue to win despite losing Pedro Martinez and El Duque Hernandez. St. Louis, of course, the story there is, can Tony La Russa turn around a team which, likewise, like the Tigers, kind of collapsed at the end of the season and played poorly, and can he keep them playing well now when it matters most?
Well, and we'll see tonight. The Mets take on the St. Louis Cardinals in the opening of their National League Series. I want to turn to the world of cycling, Bill, because, as you know, Floyd Landis, who was first the winner of the Tour de France and then shortly after disqualified with accusations of doping,
mm-hmm.
He continues to deny. He posted his defense to charges that he had too much testosterone in his blood in an online presentation on his website today. What do you make of that?
Well, you really need a chemist here, Robin, to to evaluate this stuff. Floyd Landis first complained that there were lots of different reasons that he might have tested for having too much testosterone. Might have been the whiskey he had to drink the night before one phase of the Tour de France. Might have been that his body just produces too much. Might have been this, might have been that. Now, apparently, in a couple hundred pages posted on his website, he's arguing that the testing was so flawed in so many different ways that you simply can't draw the conclusion that he cheated, that he broke the rules. So I'm not really chemist enough to evaluate all that he's saying now.
Well, finally, we hear you paid a visit to an unexpected college football powerhouse this week. I'm speaking, of course, about the University of New Hampshire.
The mighty Wildcats, yes. The Division I AA knocking off Division I teams right and left, most recently Northwestern. They've got a kid up there named David Ball who's broken the record for the division pass receiving. He's caught 51 touchdown passes in his career at UNH. And they're great fun, excitable kids having a great time on a great run.
With great leaves up there this time of year.
That too.
We'll hear more about the University of New Hampshire, more from the world of sports this weekend on Only a Game with Bill Littlefield. And as always, thanks for coming in to talk to us, Bill.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Thank you. The new documentary, Deliver Us from Evil, tells the story of Father Oliver O'Grady, a former Catholic priest who admitted to molesting hundreds of children in California in the 1970s and 80s. O'Grady was convicted of child molestation in 1993 and spent 7 years in jail. The film documents how O'Grady's superiors in the church, including Roger Mahoney, then bishop, now cardinal of Los Angeles, were aware of his problems but didn't report him to the police. Instead, O'Grady was transferred from parish to parish to continue his abuse. Here's a scene with a victim and his mother.
Started right in, grabbing me, touching me, making me touch him, telling me that why would my folks have brought me here if they didn't think it was okay.
I failed them once, and it was huge. And I'll never do it again. That will never happen again. I will never fail them again.
In her film, writer-director Amy Berg weaves court documents and depositions, interviews with victims, their families, church experts, and Father O'Grady, who now lives in Ireland. Here in us, Monica Brady Meyerhoff, who's covered the Massachusetts clergy abuse scandal, spoke with Amy Berg just after a Boston preview.
Amy, at the screening, you said that one of the things that inspired you to take on the topic of Catholic clergy sex abuse is the scandal here in Boston. Can you talk a little bit about what it was that caused you to take on the topic, and how was it to show the film here in Boston with an audience that included a lot of people who were affected by it?
If it was happening in Boston, the thought was, well, what's happening here in Los Angeles, which is where I was at the time? So it kind of provided the impetus to start researching and investigating what was going on locally. Playing in Boston, the crowd was so great. They were so supportive. They had great questions and great stories to share. And it just seemed like it was a very personal screening last night.
One of the most striking things about this film to me is that Father O'Grady, the abuser at the center of this film, admits to his crimes and he talks about them on camera. We have some sound from the film, and in this part, Father O'Grady talks about how he would respond if someone asked him, has he ever been aroused by adults?
And if they said to me, well, do you feel aroused when you see women? I'd probably say no. Do you feel aroused when you see men? No. So do you feel aroused when you see children? I said, well, maybe. How about children who are in swimsuits? I say, yeah. How about children in underwear? I say, yeah, you know. How about if you thought you saw children naked? And I said, yeah.
Amy, I've also covered this story since it first broke in the Boston Archdiocese in 2002, and I've had no success getting accused priests to speak. So it makes me wonder, how did you convince him to talk about it?
Well, it took 5 months of weekly phone calls. I actually flew to Ireland after we spoke the first time and sat down with him and talked to him about what I wanted to do and why I thought his story was so important. And he was interested in talking to me, and he was very candid and shared his tales with me. However, it took him 5 months to agree to go on camera. So it was about developing a trust, and it was about his anger towards the officials who continued to rise in power after he was defrocked.
He says in the film that he wished somebody had done something to stop him earlier. I have never heard a priest say that who's been accused of abuse. Is he just passing the buck here? Is he just blaming his superiors?
Well, no. I think that in his mind and in the research that I've done, it's an addiction. It's a sickness. Nobody wants to be that sick. And he went to the officials and confessed early in his career. And he felt that everybody knew what was going on, but they continued to allow him to be around children, to go to their houses, to spend private time with them. And he felt that he was saying something. Nobody was doing anything about it. So it just continued to get worse.
Another interesting aspect to this film about the clergy abuse scandal, because there have been several released already, is that yours focuses on a man who abused boys and girls. Here's a clip from the movie where it's one of O'Grady's victims speaking, a woman named Nancy, talking about one of Father O'Grady's superiors' attitudes about her abuse.
And he said, "We knew that you were being abused, but you were a girl. So we thought it was normal curiosity. Had you been a boy, we would have thought something was wrong with it that would have been obscene."
This was a really important thing for me. The next line that Nancy said is like homosexual. And this has been the statement for the church is that from the church, excuse me, is that this is a homosexual issue. These are priests having sex with altar boys. And if they get rid of the gay priests, then the problem will go away. In my research, there are just as many girls as boys that have been abused. And it's not a gay issue. It's sex versus rape. And these are children, and they're boys and girls. And it's very important for me to show both sides of that story. A few women came up to me last night and said, thank you, because people didn't believe them because they were girls. And they felt so connected to the girls in this story, the women in this story. And they thanked me personally because it's happened to a lot of women in Boston.
Father O'Grady was based in California in the Stockton Diocese in the 1980s, which at that time was run by Bishop Roger Mahoney. He's now Cardinal Mahoney, and he heads the Los Angeles Diocese. He admits in a deposition that you replayed in the film that he wasn't concerned if a priest had sexual urges about girls.
He had sexual urges towards a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old. Is that cause to remove him from ministry?
No.
Why do you think Mahoney is still head of the archdiocese when similar charges of knowingly transferring abusive priests from one parish to another led to the resignation of Cardinal Bernard Law in Boston?
Well, this is a question on many people's mind, and the Los Angeles Archdiocese has been manipulating the legal system, and they have not turned over the documents requested until this past May. So it's been very difficult for the district attorney's office to do what they need to do in this case. But recently they've gotten the documents, and I know that they're actively pursuing charges at this point.
And the film also implies that this may be the tip of the iceberg, not only in Los Angeles, but the United States and even internationally.
Yes. Since I started shooting this documentary a couple years ago, charges have come out in smaller European countries, in Australia, in Ireland, in England, and in Latin America, in Mexico. We're hearing so many different stories. It's just startling.
Critics of the film, such as the Catholic League, say it's unfair, especially to Pope Benedict XVI, because it accuses him of knowing about abusive priests before he was named pope, but when he was head of the Vatican office that oversees Catholic doctrine, and others have called it Catholic bashing. How do you respond?
Well, the only people who have said those two things are representatives of the church, and I say that it's not true. Pope Benedict was in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith since the early 80s, and he was then officially, in 2002, in charge of just handling these cases. But he has known about this for over 20 years.
And have you been attacked as being an outsider? You're a Jewish woman who is doing a very explosive film on the Catholic Church.
Well, I'm sure that people have a lot to say about that, but this isn't about religion for me. I came into this project as a journalist, and I attacked it in that way, and I feel that I've represented all sides of the issue.
And just a quick question, finally. The title is Deliver Us from Evil. That's a phrase lifted from the Lord's Prayer. Why use it as the title?
Well, because the survivors of sexual abuse in my film felt that there was some evil at play, and it was just interesting who was preaching from the altar. Oliver O'Grady was reciting the line, deliver us from evil, and they felt that he was evil. And it was just very ironic for them to be taking lessons from God from someone who was then also abusing them.
That's Amy Berg, writer and director of the new film, Deliver Us from Evil, speaking with Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff. For more on the film, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the new